There we go.
Second of all, spotlight.
Okay.
Okay, then we go back to gallery, and then we go to mute. Leave all participants allowed to unmute themselves. Yes, please do. And the last thing I need to do is put in the source page into the chat. So we do that.
On mute.
While I'm doing that, I have a question for everybody, and I probably should do this by a poll if I knew how to work the WhatsApp polls, which I don't. One of these days I'll figure that out. Which is, I there isn't a, I can't go back to the 7:15 time slot. It just means that I have to daven at an earlier mincha and then, kind of. So is it seven? Is 7:15 an early, an easier time for most people than 8:15, than
It's
7:30?
not.
I mean,
It's not.
7:15 is not easier than 7:30.
It's not. It makes no difference to me.
Oh,
It makes no difference to me as well.
okay.
Either way is fine.
Anybody have a preference strongly for a 7:15 of a 7:30?
7:15 with the time change, yeah.
I was going to say, time frame makes it a little harder for the for those in the East Coast. It means it's 8:30 to 9 to 9:45, just to put in perspective. But okay, we'll figure it out.
Oh, I may be on the morning too,
We
so
generally come to the morning
yeah.
one, so it
So
shouldn't make
I
a
know, that's
difference
why I
to
said you confused me.
me. Yeah, I
That's
know. Sorry. It
okay. It's okay.
was
I'll just
us
turn
that confused you.
the
Oh.
light on to instead of I'll just turn the light on to daylight and I'll be fine, All right. Let's jump in. I just posted the source page on the WhatsApp group, so we on the chat, so we should be good. And we're gonna share screen. I keep changing Zoom. Okay, I think we're here. So everybody see our text? We're good? All right. Where are we up to? So the last thing we did was, who knows, who remembers? I don't even remember if I posted last week's. Did I post last week's share? Anybody look at it? I don't remember. Okay, we'll figure it out. We were talking about the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri, and we talked a little bit about his lineage and his background. We talked about his reaction to David. David had this moment where he kind of publicly, in the inauguration, in the ceremony to accept David back as he crossed over the Jordan River, ceremony at Gilgal. There was all the tribes of Israel together, Ish Yisrael, Ish Yehuda, and David had kind of gone out of his way to favor Ish Yehuda, particularly because of the aftermath of the rebellion of Avshalom. He wanted to kind of bring them back, bring them closer. And so he reaches out to Ish Yehuda first, and then he reaches out to Amasa ben Yeter, who was the general under Avshalom's army, and he offers him the position of Yoav, and he kind of goes out of his way to bring them back into the fold. That sort of backfires because as that conflict brews, there is Sheva ben Bichri from Binyamin, sees David's favoritism towards Shevet Yehuda, makes a public statement, Vayitka b'shofar, and he blows the shofar, and he says, Ein lanu chelek b'David v'lo nachalalo b'ven Yishai, ish lo alav Yisrael. Enough, we're done. Everybody back to your tents. We will have no inheritance or portion with David, with Ben Yishai. We're out of here. Ish lo alav Yisrael. David comes back to Yerushalayim, deals with he has to do with Yerushalayim, and then he turns to Amasa, and he says to him, Okay, Amasa, you're the new general in charge of the army. Hazek li et ish Yehuda shloshit yamim ve'ata po'amot. Go call the men of Judah together. You have 3 days. I will be and meet me back here 3 days hence with the army of Judah ready to go to fight against Sheva ben Bichri. So Amasa does exactly what he was asked to do. He goes to call the men of Judah together. But that's where it all derails. Vayocher min ha-moed asher yi'ado. But he was late. He missed the deadline. He didn't show up. And so David, who at that moment had prepared for the battle with Sheba ben Bichri by trying to bring all of the tribe of Judah together in kind of an army of Judah to go and take out the rebellion of Sheba ben, or put down the rebellion of Sheba ben Bichri, is now left with a dilemma. That dilemma is partially a reflection of the fact that we don't know why Amasa failed. All we know is that Amasa did not show up. Now, Amasa could have failed for any number of reasons. We don't yet know where he is or if he's even alive. In other words, he could have gathered together, he could have gone on this mission to gather the people of Judah and the army of Ishuda, and found himself ambushed by Sheva ben Bichri. And Sheva ben Bichri could have taken him out in a terrorist attack. We simply don't know. David doesn't know where he is. Assuming he's still alive, which is as the story unfolds, it's also possible that he simply failed at the task of gathering together the army of Judah. And that's probably at this point the most likely scenario for David. The assumption that for some reason he has failed to gather the army together. He went for 3 days, and 3 days came and went, and he is nowhere to be seen. Why would it be that he failed? What are the possibilities to why he failed? So we suggested several options. I don't know if we went through them last week. There are several possibilities as to why he would have failed to gather together the army of Judah, such as, for example, why might he have failed? What are the possibilities?
Judah wasn't very happy with him that they brought Binyamin in so freely.
Should I say that again?
Judah wasn't very happy with him because...
With whom?
With David.
Well, also with the
guy. I don't think they have an issue with David. With David, after all, David was the one who went out of his way to bring them back. I mean, there are those who are part of the rebellion of Avshalom, maybe. But remember that Ishudah as an army is split. Right? You have those who supported Avshalom and those who supported David. So from that perspective, there's also, remember, who's calling them to arm? Who's inviting them now to go fight against Binyamin? The new general by the name of Amasa ben Yeter. Amasa ben Yeter was the general who fought Avshalom's army, who fought with Avshalom. Right? He was the general Avshalom had appointed in lieu of Achitophel. Which means that your army of Judah is split in their own loyalty, namely, right, those who supported Avshalom, who are now part of Ishudah, who see, the Amasa comes to them and gathers them together. Number one, they're war weary. Number two, they just fought a battle and lost. Number three, they may be not in any position to go and fight another rebellion against Amasa. Their own rebellion just failed. Why should they think that Amasa, right? Why should they risk their lives again to go and fight another rebellion? And on the other hand, those who supported David, their issue may be similar, right? They just may be war weary. But there's also a lot of suspicion of Amasa ben Yeter. Because who is Amasa ben Yeter? He was the head of the army of Avshalom. So why should they trust him to lead them into battle against Binyamin? So you know, David places an awful lot of trust in a man whose only military campaign to date has been a failure. Right, his only military expertise that we are told about in Tanakh has been the war against David in support of Avshalom, and that was a failure, obviously, because Yoav and had put down that rebellion. So the irony of David passing over Yoav in order to give the position to Amasa, is he passes over the successful general and gives the army over to the unsuccessful general, and then tells the unsuccessful general to go and gather the army back again to put down the next rebellion.
So maybe he did that. David's nephew?
So they're all nephews. Everybody here is a nephew. Yoav and Avishai are the sons of Tsruya, who's David's sister, from one side of the family. And Amasa is the son of Yeter, who is married to, one of other David's sisters, which means that David is surrounded always by his nephews.
Wow, the cousin killed each other.
Yeah, so the cousins too. That's a separate, yeah. So,
but it seems like he did it on purpose. Like that would be just pretty, like, what?
Who did what on purpose?
I'm just saying maybe David, like...
Because of the limit of the record, you know.
Okay.
No problem. You can do your regular work.
Sorry about that. Sorry, start again.
Debbie? Yeah, so I'm just saying, like, for David to go and ask him to go gather people from Yehuda, like, maybe...
Who else is he going
to
gather?
Well, I'm just saying is that for him to have him do it, like, wouldn't he have known? And then the guy didn't do it. I mean, right? So,
right. So again, what happened? We don't know. We're going to
maybe everyone knew that that was a ridiculous thing for him to ask him to do.
Yeah. The fact that they're surprised by the fact that he doesn't show up, I would argue that I don't think it's so obvious, but I do think that there's a risk involved. I agree that there's a risk involved. Whether or not it's a foregone conclusion that this is going to fail and it was a stupid attempt, I think that that's more problematic. I do believe that there is a risk involved. Risk in terms of Amasa's own proven success, a risk in terms of how war-weary Yehuda is, and how torn Yehuda still is the aftermath of the rebellion, to go follow Amasa and into battle against Binyam. And so on that level alone, it's quite possible that they simply assume that the task overwhelmed Amasa and he was unsuccessful in gathering his troops. That is entirely possible.
I got a question.
Yeah.
At this point, because we haven't read the rest, was the 3 days an unreasonable time frame? Was David putting too much on him?
So I don't know if it's about 3 days. Maybe. But let's go a little bit further in the story and we'll see. But what David does realize is that what's too much, it's not so much the 3 days, but rather the effort to gather all of Judah. Meaning, David is faced with a dilemma. He's got a rebellion in the ranks called Sheva ben Bichri. He has no idea how big this rebellion is. And so he's left with two choices. The same exact two choices Avshalom faced when David ran and Avshalom found himself in Yerushalayim. Option one was suggested by Achitophel. Take a small fighting force, go out tonight in the middle of the night under the cover of darkness and take out the leader of the rebellion. From Avshalom's perspective, that was David. Hushai, on the other hand, suggested this larger global, gather all the reserves together, gather the people, call them up to arms, and go march as an army towards a frontal, all-out assault against David. To a large extent, David is faced with exactly the same dilemma. On the one hand, he says to Amasa first, go and gather all the army together. That was Hushai's plan. That clearly fails. Now, we don't know why it failed. And we're going to have to come back to that question. We don't know why it failed yet. But he does change tactics, because what he does then is, as we see next pasuk, Vayomer David el Avishai, he then turns to Avishai ben Tsruya, who is whom? Who is Avishai?
Yoav's brother.
Yoav's younger brother, correct. Yoav's brother, who is the smaller of the two generals. Yoav was the leader. Avishai was his assistant. If you remember the battle back in the days of Ammon and Aram, Yoav was the leader of that campaign. Avishai was second to him. Avishai is certainly the lesser of the two generals, but David was still hesitant to place Yoav back on that position, back on that chair. So because he's hesitant to place Yoav on that chair, he turns to Avishai. And he says, "V'yomer David al Avishai, ata yirah lanu shevet ben bichri min Avshalom." Now we're facing a crisis, because now we don't know why Amasa died. Amasa is out of the picture. Maybe he failed to gather the troops. Maybe Sheva ben Bichri killed him. We don't know. But what we do know is, if we let this go out of hand, if we let this continue to unravel, Sheva ben Bichri will do us more harm than Avshalom did. We need to take this rebellion down now. And therefore, Ata, you, kach, et avdei adonecha, take your master servants, referring to, right, his army, his loyal guard, the servants of the king, the royal guard, if you will. Uradof acharav, go find Sheva ben Bichri. Go find him, take him out. Hen matzalo arim b'tzurot v'hitzilenenu, lest he escape into a fortified city and escape out of our sight. Meaning, we can't let Sheva ben Bichri get away. I don't have time to wait for Amasa ben Yetta to show up with the rest of the troops. We need to take out Sheva ben Bichri, go and take the king's guard, small fighting force, and go and take out Amasa ben Yetta, Sheva ben Bichri. And so that's exactly what he does. Vayitzu acharav anshei Yoav. He took together with him the people of Yoav, meaning Yoav's private fighting force. Ve'akreiti ve'apleiti, we talked about v'chol ha'giborim, all the mighty men, meaning all the core special forces, the kreiti ve'apleiti, the giborim, tzva giborim, the anshei Yoav, all of these descriptions of the small special forces. Take the people who were in Yerushalayim, who followed with David, who are the inside core group, take them, ve'etzum Yerushalayim l'rdof acharei Sheva ben Bichri. Go take them and find them. Take out Sheva ben Bichri. So David essentially turns from the campaign as a major military campaign of everybody, turns it into, and he says, okay, let's change tactics. Let's take a core group of individuals, small fighting force, special forces, and just take out the head of the rebellion, find Sheva ben Bichri, take him out. So essentially, if I go back to the Achitofel, and Hushai options to Avshalom, Avshalom's dilemma, David is faced with the exact same dilemma. He simply does them in reverse, right? He starts with the effort of a global campaign that fails because Amasa ben Yetta doesn't show up. And so he shifts gears into this very specific, very targeted campaign to take out Sheva ben Bichri. We still haven't answered the question of what happened to Amasa ben Yetta. So we'll come to it in a minute. But I want to go a couple of psukim more. Hem ima even agdala asher begivon. Actually, really helpful if I had a map. Let's see if this text will give me a map. Any chance that I'm going to get a map here? No. Okay. They come to Givon, to the great stone of Givon. We'll talk about the stone another time. Amasa balifnehem. And who shows up? Amasa. Parenthetically, v'yoav chagur midol levusho ve'alav chagur cheder mitzumedet amotna batara. Yoav was there dressed in his military outfit together with a sword fastened to his hips. V'yetzav atipol, the sword fell out of its sheath, and Yoav caught it. V'yomer Yoav la'amasa. Yoav turns to Amasa and he says to him, "Oh, ashalom. Tachi, is it well with you, my brother? Wonderful to see you." Vatoch es yad yeminin Yoav bizkan namasal in shoklo. Yoav took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to bring him close to kiss him. Ve'amasa lo nishma b'cherev asher b'yad Yoav, and Amasa didn't pay any attention to the sword that was in Yoav's other hand. Ve'akehu ba'alachomesh, and he smote him in the gut. Ve'yishpoch me'av arza, and he disemboweled. And then Yoav Avishai Achi Radaf Acharei Sheva Ben Bichri, and now they were free, Yoav and Avishai, to pursue Sheva Ben Bichri. So we'll come to the question of why Yoav kills Amasa in the next year. But what's fascinating to me is Amasa is not dead yet. Meaning, he will be at the end of the story, but that's not the point. The point is, at this point, Amasa is alive and well. He's just in Givon. So, and understand the geography for a second. David had told them to, told Amasa ben Yeter to gather together the people of Judah, which means from Yerushalayim he was to head what direction? He comes to Yerushalayim and says to them, okay, go and get, says to Amasa, go and gather all the troops of Judah. What direction would Amasa have traveled to gather the people of Judah from Yerushalayim?
South?
South. Remember, Yerushalayim is the border between Yehudah in the south and Binyamin in the north. Right? That was the whole point of Yerushalayim, is that it was the border city between Yehudah and Binyamin. So he sends Amasa southward. When he sends Yoav and Avishai to go and gather, to go and attack and find Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri is from Shevet Binyamin. Sheva ben Bichri would be where? North or south of Yerushalayim?
North.
Ish Binyamin, Ish lo alav Yisrael. Yerushalayim is the border between Yehudah and Yisrael. So Amasa ben Yeter goes south, fails to gather the troops together. Abishai and Yoav go north to pursue Sheva ben Bichri. And who do they meet in Givon? Givon is the capital of Binyamin. Who do they meet in Givon? Sheva ben Bichri. Amasa ben Yeter. Alive and well. Amasa ben Yeter. So Yoav doesn't give him the time of day to explain himself. Yoav just grabs him by the beard, brings him close, gives him a kiss of death, and disembowels him. So Yoav does not give Amasa the chance to explain himself. But the question in Yoav's mind is, what? What's the question in Yoav's mind, in everybody's mind? It's not why Amasa ben Yeter was late to the party. The question on their minds is,
what's he doing there?
What's he doing in the area of Binyamin? Right? What's he doing in Givon, which is in Shevet Binyamin? So to their military minds, there can be only one possibility, namely, right, to their military minds, there can be only one possibility. What is Amasa doing in Binyamin?
Treason.
Treason.
Treason of one sort or another. Like, he's either trying to join with the other guy, or else, you know, he's just not listening to David and David, and he's,
yeah, the likelihood of him simply not listening to David is maybe I'm not convinced that that's sort of a, you know, as simple as that. But this, on the face of it, and Yoav certainly, I think, understood Amasa's presence there as one of treason, because they're running after Sheva ben Bichri. Amasa ben Yeter is sitting there in Givon. There's no reason for him to be in Givon except to be siding with Sheva ben Bichri. What's he doing? Pursuing Sheva ben Bichri on his own to kill him? That's not the whole point, right? So to Yoav, it's a matter of, we've been looking for you. Hashalom atachi, oh, it's well with you, my brother. Meaning, you're alive and well. Here in Binyamin, in Sheva ben Bichri territory, you know, good two-faced traitor, and, you know, doesn't give him the chance to explain himself before he kills him. So this is Yoav's perspective for sure. Was Yoav right about Amasa ben Yeter? That's what I'm not convinced. We still have a mystery. We will never know why Amasa didn't show up after 3 days and why he failed to gather the troops of Judah. What we do know is he's not amongst the troops of Judah. He didn't even gather the troops and then, you know, sort of had 5,000 instead of 15,000. And so he was still going, knocking door to door and say, will you join David in the rebellion against Sheva ben Bichri? Right? He's not even there. He's completely out of the loop. He's in Gibeon in the north, in Binyamin territory, Sheva ben Bichri territory. And we are left with a mystery. All right. So to this mystery, you know that Chazal do not like vacuums and they do not like mysteries. And so Chazal insert into this story a fascinating medrash. But this medrash is so fascinating and so outlandish in its description that it's one of those moments where you have to stop and ask yourself the question, what did Chazal really say? So, what's the medrash and what's the issue? Does everybody understand the question? At this moment in time, Amasa ben Yeter is found in Shevet Binyamin in the north, in Givon. Amasa ben Yoav accuses him of treason for siding with Sheva ben Bichri, kills him for it. Chazal had a completely different take on what Amasa was doing in not arriving in time with the army of Judah. Let's just put it that way. So let's take a look at what the Medrash says. I'm going to start here. This is the source page. This is where we left off. This is the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And the Gemara says the following. Ashkechin, there's a little bit of background to the Gemara that's not here, which is that Amasa ben Yeter had gone south as Judah, as David had commanded him. And it says the Medrash, in language, Midrashic language that needs to be unpacked and understood, Ashkechinu deptiach lehu b'mesechta. Amasa found the people of Judah studying Torah in the Beis Medrash. And they had just started a new mesechta. And because he found them studying Torah in the Beis Medrash and had just started a new sugya, a new topic, a new mesechta, Amari said to himself, with regards to Yeshua, he quotes the pasuk that says, if you don't listen to the words of the leader, you'll be put to death. Maybe that means even if the king instructs you to abandon the words of Torah, to abstain from the study of Torah, Talmud Lomar, therefore the verse states, Rak Chazak V'yamatz, meaning, right? Be strong and courageous, meaning your army should be studying Torah, and that's even if it means violating the command of the king. And so Amasa ben Yeter says, you know what, I'm not going to interrupt their learning. I'll wait for them to finish the Masechta. Well, they were learning, and they were learning, and they were learning, and maybe they were learning Chafetz Chaim style, and they were going through 12 weeks for every half a page, and they were waiting. And so he's sitting there going, okay, I'm waiting. In the meantime, they never finished the Masechta. And so Amasa missed his deadline. That's the statement of the Gemara. That the reason Amasa didn't succeed in gathering the army of Judah together was the people of Judah was sitting and studying Torah, and Amasa did not want to interrupt their Torah learning. So says the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Now, you understand both why that sounds outlandish in the context of this shot of the story, but also why it's so important to unpack and understand what Chazal is saying. Because if I take this statement at face value, it seems to suggest exactly what has become such a hotbed topic in contemporary issues, namely that because they were studying Torah, they didn't have to go to fight David's wars. And is that in fact what Chazal was suggesting? And so even though it sort of takes a little bit of topic, I think it's important enough that it warrants a discussion. So first of all, we need to understand that even though there are those who may have interpret this in a vacuum in such a way, clearly that cannot be what Chazal intended in the context of the story of Amasa or the Pshat of Sefer Shmuel. I think that that's clearly the suggestion that in the pshat of the perek, the reason why Amasa ben Yefta failed to gather the troops together is because they were sitting in the base medrash learning, that is a hard argument to place back into the story. I think that we can all agree on. The bigger question is, what does Chazal mean by it? And I'll add to that question the following series of sources. This is just a small cross-section of sources that I think we should all be familiar with. The first is the Rambam and the Laws of Kings. A word about the Laws of Kings. We have a general principle that if, especially Ashkenazim, we generally paskin all halachic matters in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch. But there are whole sections of halacha where the Shulchan Aruch does not rule, because the Shulchan Aruch did not address any topic of halacha that wasn't relevant in the 16th century and applicable in the 16th century. So the laws of kings and the laws of war and the laws of an Israelite army were not relevant to the Shulchan Aruch. He has no reference for it. He has no reference of them. So when the Shulchan Aruch does not include a topic, we fall back on the Rambam, who included everything. So not only do we learn the Rambam, we actually paskin like the Rambam. That's very important. The Rambam is addressing the question of those who are exempt from war. Now, the Torah lists four exemptions: those who have first married, those who have just planted a new business or a new house, those who have just planted a vineyard, those who are afraid, and Chazal say afraid because of their own moral weakness. In another section, the Rambam talks about those who are Shevet Levi, who are exempt because they're studying Torah. When is it true that we, all these above-mentioned people, are exempt from battle? That's only in a war that is described as optional, meaning a war to expand the boundaries of Israel, a war to expand the territory, a war to that required the authorization of Sanhedrin. Okay. But if you have a war which is an obligatory war, a mitzvah war, which is defined by the Rambam himself as a war against Amalek, a war against the seven nations of Canaan, or any war that is designed to defend Israel against their enemies, war of self-defense, in any context of a mechemet mitzvah, there are no exemptions. Hakol yotzin v'afilu chatan michedro v'kala michupata. Everyone goes to war. Even a chatan from the chuppah and the bride from her bride chamber. Everybody goes. There are no exemptions. So if that's true, David was certainly fighting what he thought to be a mechemet mitzvah. This is a war of self-defense. This is a war of rebellion against of treason. So to suggest that Amasa didn't go to Shevet Yehuda because they were too busy studying Torah is problematic, just from terms of the halachic perspective itself. Second of all, here's another example. And this was an example. It's an old example for us. We studied this piece from Yehoshua way back when we learned Yehoshua the first time. Anybody remembers learning Yehoshua with me way back when? So from in St. Louis, that would have been, a second or third year. That would have been like 14 or 15 years ago. And in Toronto, that would have been closer to 25 years ago. But it was a long way ago. But Sefer Yehoshua, we have the following story. We have Yehoshua is about to enter into Yericho, right? And that was certainly against the Amei Canaan, certainly Mechemet Mitzvah. And Yehoshua is outside of the city of Yericho. It's towards the end of the Perek. And he's sitting there, and he's standing outside of Yericho, and he lifts up his eyes, and he sees Vinei Ish Omed L'Negdo. He sees a man standing there opposite him with a sword. So Yeshua approaches this stranger outside of the camp of Israel, and he says to him, "Alanu atayim letzareinu, are you for us or against us? Are you friend or foe? Who are you?" And the response is, "Vayomer lo, no, ki ani sar tzva Hashem, I am the captain of the army of God. Atabati, I have come now." Yeshua falls on his face and he says, what do you say to your servant? And the Sar Tzva Hashem, the Malach of God's army, says to him, Shalom Nalchami al Raglecha, take Yeshua off from your feet because of Makom Asher Talmid Alav Kodeshu, the place you stand is holy ground. And then the next chapter, this Malach begins to explain to Yeshua the battle plan for the takedown of Yericho, which includes walking around with the shofars for 7 days and blowing the shofar, and then the walls will come, as the song goes, the walls will come a-tumbling down. Okay. Says the Medrash, says the Radak on this pasuk, that there is a Medrash, the Gemara, and the Medrash says the following, that this Malach, this angel, came to Yeshua, la'afchidam, to frighten them, to warn them that they made a mistake. He warns them about two things. One, number one, al bitul Torah, that they abandoned the study of Torah. And number two, al shebitlu ayom she'avar tamid shel ben arba'im, that they had abandoned the korban tamid, that they didn't bring the korban the previous day because they were too busy with war preparations. To which Yeshua then said, Aleiz mehem bata, which one have you come to defend or to critique? And he said to them, says the Malach, Atabati, right? I've come now. Atabati means, Klomar, al bitul Torah. I've come now because of the bitul Torah, because you have abandoned the study of Torah. Shatam telim, because you should be engaged in the study of Torah. Miyad v'yalan Yeshua b'toch ha'imek shalan b'yom kashal halacha. Immediately it says that Yeshua slept in the middle of the valley, meaning he slept in the valley of halacha. He engrossed himself in the study of Torah. That's the Medrash. This Medrash is classically quoted as one of the primary sources in the Midrashic literature of Chazal. They say that if you're studying Torah, you are exempt from fighting in the army. Here the Malach comes to say to Yeshua, if you're studying Torah, if you're engaged in Talmud Torah, you shouldn't have stopped Talmud Torah in order to go to fight the army. Even though it happens to be one of the Mechamet Mitzvot against the Meknan, nonetheless, that's the Medrash as it's quoted. I'll deal with the Medrash in a moment. But look at the Radak's response. Says the Radak, Zehadrash, Rachok. This midrash is very far, meaning it is not pshat. Why? Ki ein shat hamilchama shat Talmud Torah. Says the Radak categorically. Time of war is not a time for studying Torah. You're talking about self-defense. The security and the well-being of the Jewish people are at stake. You're going to sit in the best medrash in Torah. That makes no sense. It's Jewish people are in danger, you fight the wars, and you go back to Talmud Torah when it's all over. And so he makes this categorical statement, Ein Shat Mechama Shat Talmud Torah. Fascinating by itself. So what is the Medrash coming to tell me? So just as a pshat in the story, this is an aside, right? What the Medrash is really saying to Yeshua is, this battle, Atabati, I have come now for this battle of Yericho. Meaning this battle of Yericho was going to be fought, the first battle in the land of Israel was going to be fought by God, by Sar Tzva Hashem. The walls would come down after you blow the shofar and you walk around 7 times. This was purely upiness. This was a reenactment of the experience of the revelation at Mount Sinai with the shofar blowing and the 7 days and the hakafot and the surrounding of the city. The walls were going to come down by God's hands. That was the way they were going to start the battle. And that may, I heard from Rav Medan once, that's an explanation of why he tells him to take off his shoe, because the shoe is a symbol of the uniform of a soldier. Not everybody wore shoes. A soldier wore shoes. So he says, you're standing on holy ground, you're meaning you're standing on God's territory, this is where you take your shoes off. This battle against Yericho is God's battle. That doesn't mean that there was no battle for Yeshua to fight. It just means that the first campaign in the land of Israel had to be such that we needed to make sure that the Canaanites knew God's power, God's hand. Like Moshe was also told to take his shoes off because God said to Moshe at the burning bush, you take my staff and you do my miracles and you represent me, because Egypt needs to know that this is me letting them go and not you. But beyond that, then there's a role for Yeshua and the army to play moving forward. So there's not a suggestion that there's this broad scale polemic that says Talmud Torah is more important than fighting the wars of Israel. That's absurd, says the Radak, because in Shat Talmud Hamilchama, Shat Talmud Torah, that's absurd. Time of war is not a time for escaping that to go and study Torah. So I don't need to explain the polemic of where this applies in today's world. Just park it, remember it, bear it in mind. It's very important for our discussion. Okay, you all understand intuitively where this is, where my headspace is going, in the context of this discussion. But I come back to the question: Amasa says the Gemara was found studying Torah. What is that all about? Amasa found Bnei Yehuda studying Torah, and therefore he didn't want to interrupt them. What is that all about? So I'll show you one more source. And this other source is the other classic source often quoted with regards to contemporary Jewish life in Israel and the supposed exemption from army service. And that's the story of Avraham Avinu. So to understand this, let's take a quick dive into the story of Avraham, which is in Chumash, Bereishit, Perek Yudalet, the battle of the four kings and the five kings. Okay, everybody with me? Everybody see where I'm going? All right. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Ayoch, king of Elasar, and Kedal Omer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, right? These are four kings, four alliances, four great nations. They made war in the land of Israel, Asum Lechama. Who did they war with? They warred with the whole Middle East, right? They weren't just warring with four little tiny cities called Sodom and Amorah. They were really, it was a major battle. But the war ended up with the kings of Sodom, Amorah, Admah, Tsoyim, and Tsoar, the five Arei Kikar. And they gathered together in Emek Sidim. They served them as servants for 12 years. They rebelled for 3 years. And in the 14th year, in the 14th year, Kedala Omer came, and he took down the entire rebellion. He smote the Rephaim and Ashtarot Kanaim and Zuzim and Emim and Chorim. He conquered the whole Middle East. I wonder if there's a map here. Let's see if there's a map here. There you go. There's a nice little map. Okay, here you have the Mesek and Ashtarot Kanaim. And this is the campaign route of the forces of Kedala Omer. They come down to HaMelech, Kiryatayim, and all the way down to El Parad, and then they come back up to Sodom, to Emek Sidim, which is Emek HaMelech, and this is where the battle takes place. So you can imagine this is where all of these forces, I actually have a different theory, which is that they came down through here and into the land of Israel, and then crossed back over to Sodom, which is some debate whether Sodom is on this side of the Jordan or this side of the Jordan. But either way, you can understand that this was a major force fighting the region totally. And in that context, it says it took out Amalek, they took out the Amorites, and Chatzitzon Tamar, which is Yericho, and then by it say Melech Sodom and Melech Amorah, and all of the kings of the five Arei Kikar, and they waged war with them in the valley of Sidim. And in this valley, they captured all the possessions of Sodom and Amorah, and amidst the possessions, what they took, they took Lot and his possessions, who Yeshem Sodom, because he was in Sodom. So they captured Lot. They came to, a fugitive came, somebody, some survivor from the battle. Some medrash says it was Og who survived the flood, but that's not my issue. It was the survivor, a fugitive came from the battle. And he was living in Elanei Mamre, together with, who was the brother of Eshkol, Achi Eshkol, Achi Aner, Vehem Balei Brit Avraham. So you have Mamre, Aner, and Eshkol, the alliances, the brethren of Avraham, meaning that Abram had entered into a contract, an alliance with these Amorites, namely Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner. Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive. So he armed his students, chanichav, his young men, yilidei beto, those who were born in his household. He armed them. 318 of them. Ve'irdof Adan, and he chased as far as Dan in the north. And he chased out the entire army of Kedala Omer. He struck in the middle of the night, ve'achakem aliyam laila, a surprise attack in the middle of the night, and he, together with the servants, he smote the armies of Kedala Omer, and he chased them, ve'irdofem ad chavash, and he swallowed Damascus, he chased them all the way back to Damascus. Okay, chases them from Hebron, Elonim, Mamre, chases them all the way up to Dan, and then back to Damascus. Okay, so he takes out the armies of Kedar Laomer. And then they all get, now he's freed everybody. He's literally liberated the land of Israel. And he's freed them all. And so they all come out to greet him. Vayetze Melech Sdom Likvato, the king of Sdom, comes out to greet him. Together with, right, he had liberated the entire land. And together with the king of Sdom comes Malki Tzedek Melech Shalem. And Malki Tzedek comes out with bread and wine. And Malki Tzedek gives him a bracha. Baruch Avram Elayon Kunei Shemayim Va'aretz. Blessed is Avraham to God on high, you creator of heaven and earth. And the king of Sodom comes along and says, Avraham, ten li nefesh, haruchush kachlach. You give us the people. Leave the people to us. Bring us back our people. And you take the possessions. And Abraham loses his temper. I took my hand in oath to Hashem, God on high, creator of heaven and earth. I would not take a shoelace from you, lest you say you made Abraham wealthy. The only thing I ask for in return is Rak asher achlu anarim mechelak anashim asher achuiti aner eshkol mamre. I ask you to provide provisions and payment and salary to those who went with me, the forces of Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, Balei Brit Avram, they should take their portion. Okay. That's the story. In a nutshell, that's the story of the battle of the four kings and the five kings. So far, are you with me? Why did Avram go to war?
Why did he go
to free? Why did Avram go to war?
Free the hostage.
To free his nephew, correct? And in so doing, he chased the armies of Kedar Omer out of the land of Israel. Okay. The next chapter, by the way, is the story of the Brit Ben Habtarim, in which God says to Abraham that, no, that your children will be slaves for 400 years in a foreign land, and that they will be enslaved there, and but that the nations that would enslave them, I will judge them, etc. Famous prophecy of the Shibud Mitzrayim, all of that's in the next chapter. Comes along the Gemara and asks the following question. Amar Rabbi Abau, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Mifnei ma ne'enash Abraham Avinu, why was Abraham punished with the promise that his children would be slaves for 210 years? 210, 400, we can argue on the chronology, not my issue. Why was the Brit Ben Habtarim, which is a reaction, a response to the battle of the four kings and the five kings, says the Medrash in this Gemara was a punishment. What was Abraham being punished for? Gemara offers two possibilities. Possibility number one, mipnei she'asa angaria b'talmide chachamim, because he drafted young Torah scholars. Angaria is a draft into army, military service. He drafted into military service young talmide chachamim. As it says, v'yarek et chanichav yilidei beito, he took his trained men, his children, his chanichim, born in his house. And he gave them arms for Yorick. He gave them weapons. And because he gave, he drafted his young Torah study scholar students, he was punished with Shibud Mitzrayim. I don't need to tell you where that's going to go, right? Okay. But Rabbi Yochanan Amar, not so fast. Rabbi Yochanan says that's not the reason he was punished. He was punished because he frished bnei adam milikanes tachat kanfei hashchina, because he prevented people from coming under the wings of the divine presence. What do you mean he prevented them? Because the king of Sodom's reaction to the victory was ten le'anefesh ra'ruchush kachlach. He says, "I want the people. You take the possessions." But what should have happened is Avram should have said, like he did in Haran, that the nefesh asher asu b'Haran. Right? He made souls. He brought them closer to God. So instead of bringing the people of Sodom, who he had liberated, closer to God, he took the possessions and gave the people back. And the end result was that the people of Sodom walked away without a sense of understanding of what it meant to be part of God's people. Those are the two opinions. It's fascinating. Either way, Abraham walks out of the story not in a good place. But what's going on here? What's going on here? So the answer, and here it's a debate, here it's two opinions. And the answer is very simply, right? What is at stake here is the question I just asked a minute ago, which is, why did Abraham go to war? And everybody just assumed it is because he went to war for what purpose? To free his nephew. Well, let me ask you something. If he went to free his nephew, as important as that is, pikuach nefesh, I get it. But pikuach nefesh for one individual, in so doing, he now endangered his own people, his own household, his own students, and the Balei Brit Avraham, Ena, Eshkol, and Mamre. He took three armies with him, and all of them put their lives on the line and fought a world war to free Avraham's nephew? Are you entitled to endanger the entire region of the Middle East in order to, and all of his armies and all of his Balei Brit because you want to free one individual, because you want to free your nephew? To my mind, freeing your nephew sounds like a personal campaign. Personal campaign, Avraham, take yourself. But don't endanger the entire world. Don't pull, in the language of the Medrash, don't pull the students out of the Beis Medrash because you have a personal need to go and fight the war to save your nephew. Right? On the other hand, there's another way to look at the story. This has nothing to do with Avram's nephew. Avram's nephew is a pretense. What's really at stake here? What's really Avram's agenda here? Much bigger than Avram's nephew, right? Your entire region, all these maps come from. Every time I look at this, it's different maps. But your entire region, let's go back to those maps we saw before, right? Your entire region has now been taken over by Kedar LaOmer. He's conquered the entire Middle East. Right? And your campaign to free the forces of Kedar LaOmer and to free Sodom essentially is your opportunity to conquer the entire Middle East in a war of self-defense against the conquering armies of Kedar LaOmer. This is a war of national importance. The entire region is ablaze. This is a major war. And if you don't stop Kedar LaOmer and his forces now, with today's Sodom, the rest of tomorrow, the rest of the land of Canaan. And so Avram goes
didn't they taunt him and say, ha ha, we have your nephew?
Mm-mm. Well, I don't know where it says that. They took people of Sodom captive. I don't think they've even heard of Avram before Avram showed up in the battlefield in the middle of the night. They captured all the people of Sodom, which happened to include Avram's nephew. Yevor Palit, the fugitive, the remnant of the battle, came and he told Avraham that they had conquered the entire region, including Sodom. So Avraham gathered all his people together and he says, it's time to put a stop to Kedar LaOmer and his forces. And he literally liberates the entire land of Canaan from the forces of Kedar LaOmer. Now, the big question is, What happens next? You, Abraham, you have, you know, it's fascinating. When Abraham shows up in Hebron, Perak, right? This is Bereshit, this is in Parshat Vayera. At the end of this parasha, we have this, this is actually Lech Lecha. Then you have the story of the Akedah, and then you have whatever. By the time Abraham comes to Hebron to bury Sarah, if you remember, what is the, how is he described? He's described as Nesi Elokim Ata Bikirbeinu, the prince of God in our midst. How did Avram earn the title Nesi Elokim when he came to the land of Canaan as a traveler from Haran? I think the answer is after Kedalaomer, after the battle of Kedalaomer. No, Avram was, it was it. He was the king of the land. He was the he had literally liberated the entire Middle East from the forces of Kedalaomer. What Avram couldn't have done demanded at that time. Malkitzedek got it. Malkitzedek came to him and he said, Melech, Baruch Avraham le'el ayom konei shamayim v'aretz. But for some odd reason, the king of Sodom doesn't get it. And the Medrash holds Avraham accountable for is not using that moment to transform, to call out in the name of God, to literally identify this battle, not as Abraham's battle, but as God's battle, and as an opportunity to take all of the people, including the people of Sodom, and bring them under the banner of understanding, like Yericho, that this battle was fought by God. And that's precisely what you have in this Medrash. The Medrash says there were two reasons. There were two arguments as to why Abraham was punished in the aftermath of this campaign. One was because, we'll come back to the Engaya. Let's assume for the moment he had a national campaign. He had a national agenda. He needed to free the land of Israel from the conquering forces of Kedorlaomer. Nothing is more praiseworthy and more appropriate than that. When the battle was over, you had a responsibility to proclaim this battle. You had an obligation to acknowledge that this was by God's hand. And therefore, the fact that Melech Sodom can utter this ridiculous statement of you give the people back to us, you take the money, only said that there was a failure in the educational framework of this battle. Their perception of it was that Avraham only came to free his nephew. Well, if Avraham only came to free his nephew, if it was personal and not national, then you had no right to endanger all of the people who, in the language of the Medrash, are studying the Beis Medrash. Meaning, it was a personal campaign to free one person. For that, you don't endanger the entire region. So that's at the core of what I think the language of Chazal, and the language when Chazal talk about the fact that Abraham endangered them by the took them out of the Beis Medrash to fight his battle, is essentially saying part of the debate was, how do you perceive this campaign? Was it personal or national? If it was personal, you don't have a right to take the people out of the Beis Medrash or to endanger the entire region. If it's national, then it needed to have the framework of a national campaign fought in the name of God in order to justify it. Okay? That's where, that's the background. So now let's go back to the story of Amasa ben Yetter. What's going on here? David comes to Amasa ben Yetter and he says to him, go and take all of the army of Israel and gather together for 3 days. Because Sheva ben Bichri is a bigger threat, even than Avshalom. And when Amasa ben Yetter doesn't show up for 3 days, he turns to Avishai and he says, Ata yera lanu Sheva ben Bichri min Avshalom. David is more concerned about Sheva ben Bichri than Avshalom. Was he right? Was Sheva ben Bichri a bigger threat than Avshalom? Was Sheva ben Bichri a threat at all? What did Sheva ben Bichri say? There was this big ceremony back on the banks of the river before David even came to Yerushalayim. And where David had favored Judah, and the people of Binyamin were upset, and Vayitka b'shafar. So what did he say? He said, Ish lo alav Yisrael. Every man back to his tent of Israel. Meaning what? In the language of David, what does that mean?
Back to the tribes.
Right? In the language of David, that's a full-scale, all-out rebellion. This is Sheva ben Bichri is now going to launch an assault against the kingdom. We need an army to put him down, just like we had needed an army to put down Avshalom. Is that, in fact, what he meant? I don't know. We're in the middle of a ceremony.
He meant that the tribes are...
We don't know what he meant. But we're in the middle of a ceremony to anoint the king... And Binyamin got insulted that the anointment ceremony took place with Judah on the other side of the Yarden, comes back to Gilgal, that a whole of a celebration set up. So Sheva ben Bichri stood up, blew the shofar, and he said, you know what, Rabbi Osai, reception canceled. Reception canceled, go home.
Says he was a wicked fellow.
It says he was a wicked fellow. He was a wicked fellow. Does that mean he's a full-scale rebellion with an army? What army does he have? Hence my question. What army does Sheva ben Bichri have? We don't know. Take a look a little bit further down the parak. They deal with Amasa. Amasa's body has to be moved out of the way. Not our issue for now. Then they continue the chase after Sheva ben Bichri. They go through all the tribes of Israel and they come to Avel Beit Ma'acha. Avel Beit Ma'acha is, according to most Mefarshim, is one city. It's today identified somewhere near Tel Aviv. And so Yoav and Avshalom follow him. They come, they besiege the city of Avel Beit Ma'acha. And they bring up a moat against the city and a mound, and they besiege the city. And there's an Isha Chachama in the city, and she comes and she says to Yoav, 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 I want to talk to you. So she comes to Yoav outside of the tent, outside of the city walls, and she says, what's going on here? What are you coming to attack? We're loyal people. We're a loyal city. We're loyal. We are loyal to David. Anochi Mishlamei Amunei Yisrael. I am of a peaceful and loyal person to Israel. A time of vacation, I meet Ir Vembi Israel. You want to destroy the entire city of Evod Machal? What's going on here? So Yoav says, no, Chas V'Shalom, I don't want to destroy anything. But there's a person from Har Ephraim, his name is Sheva ben Bichri, and he's rebelled against the king, and he's hiding inside the city. Give us Sheva ben Bichri, we'll leave you alone. Give me 6 hours. I'll go back inside. I'll negotiate this with the city. I will send his head to you over the wall. And that's exactly what she does. She comes in with all of her wisdom. They cut off Sheva ben Bichri's head. They throw it over the wall. Sheva blows the shofar. Rebellion over. What army does he have? He doesn't even have an army. He has one city. He gets into one city, and even that city's not on his side. He's got nothing. He's an idiot. He's a Sheva ben Bichri. He's a Ishbliyal. He calls out, he canceled the reception, and everybody went home. And the next day they woke up and they said, what's going on here? David's gone to war? That's the question. Is David going to war justifiably or unjustifiably? And we don't know. At the point in Pasuk Dalet, when he calls over Amasa and he says to him, go and gather the army together because now Sheva ben Bichri is a bigger threat than Avshalom, is he right or is he wrong? We don't know. But I'm pretty sure if we don't know, Amasa ben Yetter didn't know either. And what do? You have an entire army. You're going to gather the army together and threaten everybody. So in the language of Chazal, in the code language of Chazal, he found them studying Torah. Meaning what? He found them meaning, are they ready for going into battle again or not ready to go into battle again? I don't know. And so he abandons his post, so to speak, and he escapes to the only place where he can. But it's not an escape. Why does Amasa ben Yeter go to Gibeon? Why do Yoav and Avishai find him in Gibeon? Why is he in Shevet Binyamin? What's the answer? What's in Gibeon? What's in Gibeon? Heim im ha'even ha'gdola she'begivon. They come to the great stone of Gibeon. What is the even ha'gdola asher begivon? What is Gibeon? That's the whole story. What's the answer?
Is that the place that the tribes put up, like, an altar? And then they said, are you separating from...
No. So if you're sure, no. But you're close. Take a look at this pasuk. Divrei bet perak aleph. Vayechu Shlomo v'chol kahal imo. This is the beginning of the story of Shlomo HaMelech. He, together with all of the people with him, labama asher b'givon, to the great high place, the Mizbeach, which was in Givon, ki sham haya oel moed olokim asher asam Moshe v'ad Hashem b'midbar, for that's where the Mishkan was. Not the Ark. The Ark itself was in Kiryat Yearim. But the Mishkan, the Mizbeach, and all of the other parts of the Mishkan that Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur made, that we read about these parashiyot, they're all in Gibeon. The Mishkan sat in Gibeon after it was destroyed in Nov, moved to Gibeon. And so if Amasa is in Gibeon, what's he doing there? I'm actually going to stop sharing at this point. If Amasa is in Gibeon, why is he in Gibeon? David sent him to gather the troops together in a battle, in a rebellion against Sheva ben Bichri, but Sheva ben Bichri is a mystery. We have no idea who he is. We have no idea what he is. We have no idea whether he's in the right battle, the wrong battle. Is he fighting the wrong enemy? Is he fighting the right enemy? What do you do when you don't know what to do?
You bring a carbon.
Or you consult. Who do you consult? If you can't go back and consult with David, that would be silly. Right? Prophets, Nevi'im, Kohanim, Urim B'Tumim. You sit, you pray, you do something. They found Amasa ben Yeter by the Even Agdolah Asher B'Givon, by the Mishkan. Maybe he wanted to escape. Maybe he wanted to seek asylum. He knew that he was committing treason by not fulfilling the mission. So he sought to seek asylum in the Mishkan. The Mishkan is extraterritorial. The Mishkan, you can seek asylum for the Mishkan. We don't know. But the mystery of Amasa ben Yeter is that he shows up not just in Gibeon, but by the Even HaGdolah Shebegibeon, by the Mizbeach. And so in the language, if you pull apart the code language of Chazal by the story of Abraham, by the Engaria Shel Tamin HaChachamim, where he talked about the fact that did he go to war against the four kings for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? The language they use is always this language of, are you endangering the spiritual enterprise of the Jewish people? We call that Talmud Torah. Are you endangering the spiritual enterprise of the Jewish people for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? Abraham, same question. David HaMelech, Sheva ben Bichri, same question. You are endangering the enterprise, the spiritual enterprise of the Jewish people. It has to be for the right reasons. And when Amasa ben Yeter doesn't know the answer, he runs to Gibeon. And Yoav and Avishai, who find Amasa there, they don't give him a chance to explain himself because they kill him before he can open his mouth. But they killed him because they thought he had committed treason for running away into the territory of Sheva ben Bichri. And so it's a series, we call it tragedy of errors, right? It's a series of mistakes, but at the end of the day, helps us understand not just the dilemma that David is facing, but also the story of Yoav and Amasa, and the broader context, the language Chazal use whenever they talk about soldiers studying Torah. You're talking about kind of a code phrase for the question of the integrity or the spiritual validity of the campaign at hand, if it's justifiable, everybody goes to war. If it's not justifiable, then it becomes complicated and problematic. And that's what Chazal describe the story of Amasa Manyata. All right, we've overstepped our limits, so we will stop here. I apologize for we always had an hour and 15 minutes, but starting late means we end even later. So
that's your drama.
Excuse me?
It's a drama.
It's always a drama. It's always a drama. That's Tanakh. All right.
So are you saying that you think Sheva ben Bichri also may have gone for the same reason?
No, Sheva ben Bichri was an Ish Belial. Sheva ben Bichri was a no good neck. What I'm saying is that we don't know if Sheva ben Bichri was an all-out, full-scale rebellion or just a troublemaker who happened to cancel the reception party, to put it in those terms. We just don't know. But rather than finding out, David sends Amasa ben Yeter, and Amasa ben Yeter is now left with a dilemma, and so he chooses to sit it out, go to Givon, rather than engage in it, and unfortunately he pays that.
Well, we don't really know that because he also went to the same place that Sheva ben Yeter was, or Sheva, whatever, ben Bichri was.
No.
So we don't
Sheva ben Bichri is not anywhere near there. Sheva ben Bichri ends up in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
The two of them never meet. Right? We don't know why he went to Givon because Yoav doesn't give him the chance to speak. But there's no encounter between Amasa ben Yeter and Sheva ben Bichri at that point.
Okay, thanks.
No problem.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
No problem. Have fun. Enjoy.